We're back. I'm Paula Gordon, and I want to talk with David Halberstam a little bit more about this sense of community that grew out of the movement, which became the community for the people of whom you speak.
It was a community of conscience. These young people came together, young black students in Nashville, in the fall of 59 and early 60. They didn't know each other, but they became each other's friends, many of them for the rest of their lives,
and they
as I became a friend of theirs as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, because they shared something. They shared these risks. They were from different cities, different colleges. They had, you know, different tones of skin, which was in those days at a black college a rather significant defining thing. Blacker was supposed to be worse, and lighter skin meant you were better, smarter, and richer. And I mean, in the sociology of pigmentation as it existed in those days. But they were working for what Jim Lawson, who was their teacher, called, and was a great expert on Gandhi and nonviolence, called the beloved community. This was a place where, you know, people would have fewer differences, less tension, less violence, and they created what John Lewis called a community of conscience, and they were driven by a very powerful religious faith. I mean, it was religiously driven. Jim Lawson was a very prophetic Methodist minister. He was really more advanced in his knowledge of Gandhian nonviolence than Martin King was. They were young ministers, the sons of ministers, born the same year, I believe, 1927. And Jim had been a conscientious objector in the Korean War, unusual for a black minister, and spent 3 years in India because he thought that nobody reflected the prophetic vision of Jesus Christ in modern times so much as Mohandas Gandhi. That is, if Christ came back in modern dress, he would have been Gandhi. And so he went to India in search of Gandhi's footsteps, and came back really knowing how to teach the Gandhian truths to these young people.
And Jim Lawson is not known as a name to most people in America.
He's a secret hero of the civil rights movement, but a lot of people are secret heroes of the civil rights movement. Not many people really know how great a hero John Lewis is. Not many people. Many of the people I write about in this book, Diane Nash, very few people know how great a heroine she was in these critical years.
Bernard Lafayette.
A young man named Bernard Lafayette, who there's a photo of him in the book after he's been almost murdered in Selma, Alabama. It looks like a bullet hole in his head. And Bernard, who's one of the young Nashville kids I write about at great length, Bernard is the first person to go into to bring a voting rights drive into a little town in Alabama called Selma. And that's the beginning of the movement in Selma, which 4 years later climaxes in what I believe and others believe to be, in effect, the Gettysburg of the civil rights movement, where they keep challenging this very rigid, recalcitrant, racist local government, and the government lashes back under a particularly ignorant and brutal sheriff named Jim Clark, and culminating with the beating of John Lewis on the Pettus Bridge, and you get the Voting Rights Act of 65. So that's the Gettysburg. I mean, that with that, the movement in its legal, political incarnation has won the critical battle. Mm-hmm. But who knows Bernard Lafayette? Who knows Jim Lawson? Who knows? I mean, we've not paid much attention. I mean, barely who knows Martin King anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's back to what Bill says about looking for heroes.
Well, I'm trying to understand our current challenges. And listening to you, I'm wondering how today the media, as it is constituted, would deal with the kinds of things that were going on, or would it even be possible in the current climate?
Well, it's very hard to imagine this sort of today, because, I mean, I remember when I went to Vietnam, I was one of about five or six reporters on
this. Was in the early 60s.
Very early 60s, 62, 63, 64, and a very big story. There are five or six of us. Today there'd be thousands. I don't know if you could operate that way in a media society. Would, you know, I mean, that much media gear would speed up the cycle. I don't know that you could have this slow playing out over 5 years. I just don't know. And I don't know that today's, you know, I think there are a lot of really good journalists out there on the pay on a lot of good papers, but they're not the people who are getting all the attention. When you look at the Saturday or Sunday talk shows, or you see the television magazine shows, you're seeing really old-fashioned reporters who go out, do something pretty well, work hard, but don't get a lot of celebrity credit. What the country watches on the weekends or in these half-hour, hour shows a night are the celebritization of journalism, which is probably a contradiction in terms.
It had never occurred to me that journalists perhaps should take a vow of poverty.
Well, I don't know if you have to take a vow of poverty.
I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think that's necessarily important, but I think there's a moment in there where you ought to be wary about whether you've lost your capacity to do your best serious work. If you're getting that much money and you're doing almost nothing but celebrities and it's driven for ratings and everything is about ratings, then you ought to know that there's been some co-optation going on. I mean, I think, you know, Ted Koppel makes a lot of money, but he's not been co-opted. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of people who don't like to ask. I think you get caught up in a dynamic and you get on these shows and suddenly you're supposed to be on every week and have a big story every week. Well, you can't be on every week and have a big story every week because it takes a lot of time to get stuff right.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't do it. It's done by the producer system. I once had an argument with Mike Wallace about 10 years ago during the Westmoreland trial, and I did not like his coverage of the Westmoreland trial, which was, it wasn't a 60-minute show, but it was a 60-minute technique, and he had come in the last minute, the story, which had some real legitimacy. I mean, they had cooked the books out there in Saigon, but they just did it in a haphazard way, and they had, among other things, Westmoreland tricking Lyndon Johnson, when in fact the truth was that Westmoreland, in cooking the books, was doing it to give Lyndon Johnson what he wanted. And so Mike apparently took some offense to something I said and called me up rather angrily to say, ask me whether I had said these things. And I said, yes, indeed, I said them. And he said, is it personal? And I said, no, it's not. And I said, I just don't like the way you and 60 Minutes operate. I mean, you know, this is a story. You got it wrong. And it's something, you went in and did a slapdash thing. The producers did all the work. You got all the credit. And you did it in a weekend. It's a story that's 10 years of my life. And he said, well, that's what you do. That's what happens, he said. I remember exactly what he said. That's what happens when you do 35 shows a year. And I said, Mike, do fewer. You know, I could make a lot more money
exactly.
if I did a book every 2 years instead of every 4 years.
Yeah.
But the books wouldn't be as good.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you talk about how good this book is. I'm wondering if
I like it.
Well, you should like it. It's a wonderful book.
But it's also getting the best reviews in my life.
So somebody else likes it,
yeah.
too.
Either that or you've worn them down.
Somebody out there likes it.
Is it not possible that it is the greatness of the story that calls out greatness in you?
Well, the particular validity of this
you
book.
You were pretty great before David
Halberstam. No,
Halberstam.
I mean, I don't know. The validity of this book, and it's not greatness in me, is that I had the good sense to keep myself out of it and get out of the way. I had a great story to tell. It is the single best moment in this society, democratic moment, in this society since World War II, in terms of changing the society for something that is demonstrably better. I mean, if you don't think that, think of trying to take your child around the richest, strongest nation in the world and go through South today and see signs that say white only, colored, found. I mean, thank God we got this done. What I covered and wrote about was a great citizen revolution, and it was done by the people least favored by circumstances in this country at the time of their birth. I mean, that's what makes it so remarkable. The poorest children from the poorest section of the country, from the poorest families, many of them born at the time of the Depression, and their parents barely in a cash economy, most of them about to be the first members of their family ever to go to college. And 6 years after Brown versus Board of Education, because there had been no change in their lives, the pace of social racial change was as almost as fast as molasses. It was effectively to integrate, the Southern strategy was to integrate one child per school per year in the whole state and register one voter per county per year. I mean, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
They, risking their lives, take this struggle, this noble idea, and go into first the sit-in counters, lunch counters in Nashville, and then in a section of the book that I call The Valley of the Shadow of Death, starting with the Freedom Rides, go into the Deep South. And they win. And it is a luminescent moment in democracy, and they do it based on a religious faith. I had sensed enough to get out of the way of the story. I'm not in the story. Even there's about, a, I guess, 2,000-word author's note at the end that tells how I happened to get there and be there, coming down from Harvard in 1955, working in Mississippi, and then going to Tennessee. The editor wanted me to put the author's note in the front of the book, and I said, not this time. I mean, because I didn't want to be in the way of their moment.
This is David Halberstam. We're going to talk more with him when we come back. Please do stay with us.